as is Roberta. Happy landings, Helen murmured to Joshua. Sally Lindsay's name for it, right? Seems to have stuck. Happy landings where all the kids are super smart. That's what they say. She glanced uneasily at Dan, who seemed to be trying to tie his legs in a knot.
It's good for you to have met a schoolmate already, Dan, Joshua said.
Actually, I will not be here long, Roberta said, politely enough, but rather blankly. I've been invited to join the East 20 Million mission.
Joshua goggled.
With the Chinese?
Montacute smiled.
And me, he admitted, though I'll be there more in a supervisory capacity. Roberta has won a sort of scholarship, a gesture of good faith between the datum U.S. government and the new regime in China, all of which is by the by.
Well, he stood up.
Why don't I show you around the school, Dan? While Mom and Dad grab a coffee, perhaps. Our canteen is just down the corridor.
Dan followed him, willingly enough.
So, what do you like at school? Logic? Mathematics? Debating? Technical drawing?
Softball, said Dan.
Softball? Anything else?
Wood chopping?
Really? I've got a badge.
Joshua and Helen glanced at each other, and at the silent, serious Roberta. Then, coffee, they said together, and followed Montacute and Dan out of the room. Chapter 10. To get to see her father, Helen actually had to make an appointment, which infuriated her. Jack Green, 60 years old, had an office in the modest building which served as Valhalla's City Hall, courtroom, police headquarters, and mayor's residence. He was working when Helen was shown into the room, sitting behind a desk, laden with a laptop, a couple of cell phones, a stack of grainy-looking writing paper. A big TV screen was fixed to the wall. He barely glanced up at the daughter he hadn't seen since... when? The Christmas before last? Now he held up one finger, eyes fixed on the laptop, while she stood there, waiting. At last he tapped a key with finality and sat back.
There. Sent. Sorry about that, honey.
He got up, kissed her cheek, sat down again.
Just a few last tweaks to the speech we've been writing for Ben.
Ben being Ben Keyes, she knew, mayor of Valhalla, for whom her father worked.
Oh, which reminds me. He picked up a remote and pressed it.
The big wall screen lit up, with an image of a podium, a couple of aides in suits, the stars and stripes, and the ocean blue flag of Valhalla hanging from poles side by side in the background.
Ben's delivering the speech any moment now. Talk about last minute, right? But as soon as he's done, his words will be all over this world, of course. And we'll go all the way down to the datum as fast as the outer net can carry them. Impressive, huh?
Evidently, Helen had picked a bad moment to call.
Can I sit down, Dad?
Of course, of course.
He got up again, a little stiffly, and pushed over a chair for her. Like many of his generation, who had built long earth towns like Reboot from scratch in his late middle age, he was plagued by arthritis.
How's Dan?
You got his age wrong on the last birthday card you sent.
Sorry about that. I hope he wasn't upset.
She shrugged. He's used to it. He smiled, but he kept glancing at the screen. She pushed down her irritation.
I'm just dropping in, Dad. You know, we're going on to the datum. We're here to show Dan around the free school. We're hoping to get him a place, if it suits him.
Good idea, Jack said firmly. That's one point of Valhalla, of cities like this, to found good schools and incubate free, open, and educated minds, essential in any democracy.
Dad, less of the lectures.
Sorry, sorry, it's just my way, honey. And I'm sorry to be distracted, but the situation is urgent. It's not just the increasingly repressive taxation. There's a vicious undercurrent that seeps out of the Humanity First douchebags who are paying for Cowley's re-election campaign, no matter how inclusive he pretends to be. It's worse than racism. In their language, we steppers are a lesser species. We're malevolent, moral-free mutants. We have to stand up for ourselves, and now we're doing it. Some of the commentators are already saying that Key's speech today will be our Declaration of Independence moment, before they've even heard the text. Think of that.
And you just have to be involved, don't you?
Well, what else should I be doing?
You were just the same at Reboot, distracting yourself from your own life by ordering other people around, right?
What's this? Are you channeling your sister?
Katie, a few years older than Helen, married, had stayed in Reboot, and generally disapproved of the rest of the family moving out.
No, Dad. Look, I know you're not old.
I'm not about to become a Minuteman, honey.
I know. I just think you need to stop running away.
Running from what?
It wasn't your fault Mom got ill.
Go on, he said. What else wasn't my fault?
It also wasn't your fault Rod did what he did.
Your brother planted a nuke under Data Madison, for God's sake.
No, he didn't. He was part of a dumb plot by resentful Home Alones, which... I'm sorry, Dad. It's just that I think you're working on all this stuff to
assuage some kind of Freudian guilt? My daughter, the psychologist.
His tone turned harder now.
Look, it's not about blame or guilt. People do what they do. But that doesn't mean that, whatever your deeper hidden personal motives, you can't try to do something good.
She pointed at the screen.
Like your Mayor Keyes right now?
He turned that way. Ben Keyes walked up to the podium, a sheaf of pulpy, locally manufactured paper in his hands. Aged maybe 40, he had media star good looks, but he'd let his hair grow long, pioneer style, and he wore not a suit, but a practical worker's coverall in a drab olive. When he began to speak, Helen could barely make out his words over the clapping and hollering from an offstage audience.
People of Valhalla! This is an historic day in this world, in all the worlds of the Long Earth. Today, we have it in our power to begin the world over again.
Her father grinned.
Tom Paine, that was one of my lines. Certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it.
Ha! Jack Green clapped his hands. And that is straight out of the Declaration of Independence.
What a moment for an American government to have its own founding principles thrown right back at it.
Now the screen showed images of the crowd before Keyes, who were making sign language gestures, just like the troll at the Gap, and chanting,
I will not! I will not!
Helen had lost her father to the screen, to the speech, to the commentaries that would follow. Quietly she stood and crept out of the room. He didn't look round. Helen knew nothing about revolutions. She couldn't imagine what might flow from this moment. She did wonder, however, about where the rights of the trolls and other creatures who had to share the Long Earth with mankind might fit into all this. Thomas Kayangu was waiting for her in the lobby, with sympathetic eyes. She guessed he knew enough about her complicated family now to understand how she was feeling.
Come on, he said. I'll stand you a Valhalla coffee.
And in a cozy coffee shop a couple of blocks away, Thomas told her something of his own story. Chapter 11. Thomas Kayangu could remember precisely the day his life had turned. The day he had left the conventional world and become a professional coma, if that wasn't a contradiction in terms. It had been 20 years ago, just 5 years after Step Day itself, when the whole phenomenon was still startling and new. Thomas had been 30 years old. He had borrowed his father's car, had driven out of Jigalong to a weathered wooden marker, and climbed out into the midday heat, stepper box at his side. Apart from the dirt road back to Jigalong and a fenced-off scrap of blood-stained land that marked the portal to Stepwise Rue Farms, there was nothing here, even in the datum. Nothing but the expanse of the western desert, vast, crushing, its flatness broken by a single, heavily eroded bluff of rock. Nothing, anyhow, in the eyes of the first Europeans to come here, who had barely been able even to see the people who already lived here. To them, it was a terra nullius, an empty land, and that had become a legal principle, which justified their land grab. But Thomas was a half-blood Matu. He had always been welcomed by his mother's people, even though her marriage to a white man for love had broken the Matu's strict marriage rules. And to Thomas's eyes, educated in the ways of his ancestors, at least to a theoretical level, this land was rich, complex, ancient. You could feel the weight of deep time here. He knew how this, at first glance, barren land worked, how it supported its freight of life. He even knew how to survive, how to feed himself out here, if he had to. And he knew of a secret out here that was his alone. He bent to look into a cave, cut into the side of the bluff by millennia of wind. It was hardly a cave at all, just a hollow, half-choked by dry, drifting sand. But it was a sight he had discovered for himself as a boy, visiting his grandparents at Jigalong, exploring alone in the bush. Even then, he'd been a solitary kid. And, so deep inside the cave you had to crouch to see, there was the hunting man, as he called it, a stick figure with some kind of spear chasing a huge, ill-defined creature, while spirals and starbursts spun around him. It was thousands of years old, he'd figured out, as you could tell by the patina over it. And, as far as he knew, it had been discovered by nobody before his own boyish eyes had settled on it. Nobody found it later, either. He'd kept the secret of it ever since. He'd always thought of the hunting man as a kind of friend, an invisible companion, a stable point in a life of whirling change. Thomas had been a bright kid, picked out of the local school and groomed for better things. He'd gone to college at Perth and even spent some time in America before returning to Melbourne to become a whiz kid games designer. He'd been black enough to serve as a poster boy for liberals, white enough that those around him had been able to treat him as one of their own. Then he'd had his crisis of conscience, and he started to find out about the plight of the people he'd left behind, his mother's family. How a culture, a staggering 60,000 years old, a people free and self-sufficient a mere 3 centuries ago, had become the most dependent on the planet, marginalized, removed from their lands, shattered by unemployment and drug abuse, their culture broken up by forced evictions and white education. How in his own grandmother's time, her clan had been moved from their country to avoid the British Blue Streak missiles test-launched from Woomera. Granted, all this hand-wringing had been brought on by Thomas's own beating up by a bunch of thugs in Sydney, who didn't like his kind in their city, even one in a suit and tie. But it was a real eye-opener, even so. Then he'd got married. Hannah was a trainee lawyer, another bright young thing, white, from a well-connected New South Wales family. They'd been hoping for a kid. But then the cancer had taken her, and that had been that. She had been just 23. Helen could sympathize with that part of his story, remembering the suddenness of the loss of her own mother. After that, Thomas's work seemed pointless. He'd gone back to Perth and worked for a progressive association there, promoting Aboriginal rights. And he'd taken the chance to study his mother's culture. He'd even become a native guide for parties of earnest white tourists. His mother's family had sneered at that, but he'd learned a lot. And then had come the stepper box, and the opening up of the long earth. Another huge jolt to Thomas's personal universe, as to everybody else's. Many Aborigines, especially young men, had immediately grasped the potential of the technology and stepped away in search of a better world than the datum and its bloody history. Thomas himself had rarely stepped in those early days, save for a couple of experiments, Why should he? After all the turnarounds in his life, Thomas no longer felt he knew who he was. He was a contradiction, neither white nor black, married but alone. What was he going to discover about himself out in all those other worlds that he couldn't find right here? Rather than travel forward, he kept on being drawn back, in fact, to the same point, the hunting man in the cave, the one stable locus in his life, like a nail hammered through his psyche. But this time, he had come back here with his stepper. He had an experiment in mind. He picked a direction at random and turned the switch. Australia, West 1. They were farming kangaroos here, as indeed they were in East 1. He saw heaps of carcasses, tethered horses, a stack of bronze-based rifles heaped up like a teepee. A couple of ranchers sat on a log. When they saw Thomas, they raised plastic bottles of beer to him. He waved back. Roo farming was becoming commonplace, even in the datum. Kangaroos were efficient as food animals. Pound for pound, a roo needed a third the plant material a sheep did, a sixth the water, and produced almost no methane. Roo farts were parsimonious. Thomas didn't object for any rational reasons. It just didn't feel right. Anyhow, this new world was an annex to the old, and nothing to do with him. He stepped away, to West 2, and 3, and 4. Each step was a wrench to the stomach, and he needed time to recover. It took him 2 hours to get to West 10, where he stopped. He sat on an eroded shelf at the edge of the rocky outcrop, which appeared unchanged from the original in the datum. He looked around, taking his time, absorbing the new world. And off in the distance he saw movement. A herd of some huge, slow-moving, rather lumbering creatures, seen in silhouette against a pale blue sky. Walking on all fours, they looked like rhinos to his untutored eye. Presumably, they were some marsupial equivalent, perhaps hunted by a local version of a lion. There were kangaroos here too, standing up, plucking at the lowest leaves of some tree. But these were big animals, bigger than any roo in the datum, big and muscular. And there, scampering in the distance, a thing like a dinosaur, a raptor, that was probably a flightless bird. The world was intensely silent, save for the distant bellow of one giant herbivore or another. He drank water from a plastic bottle. Some of the nearer worlds had been visited by hunters unable to resist the lure of going after the native megafauna, but here, 10 steps out, there was no sign of humanity, not so much as a footprint. And it was a different sort of world, without humans. Naively, you'd think that one copy of the Western Desert was going to be much the same as any other. Not so. This country was always going to be arid, but Thomas could see at a glance that it was greener than he was used to, with patches of tough-looking grass, scrubby trees. On the datum, his mother's people had shaped the land with fire for 60,000 years. This was a land without Europeans, but without the Matu and their ancestors too. Thomas wasn't here for the flora and fauna, however. When he felt well enough to stand, he walked around the bluff to the cave, it was here just as in the datum, and knelt down, the stepper box awkward at his waist. He had to shield his eyes against the light of a descending sun to see inside. And there it was, in the cave. Somehow, he had known it would be. Not his hunting man, not exactly. Another human figure, chasing another crudely sketched animal. Around it, a different array of spirals and starbursts and hatchings and zigzags. And when he touched the drawing, cautiously, he could feel the patina that covered it. It was every bit as ancient as the one in the datum, put there by some scrawny guy who had figured out how to step, all by himself, millennia ago. He sat with his back to the rock. He would have laughed, save he didn't want to disrespect the silence, or indeed draw the attention of any nearby marsupial lions. Of course, there must have been Aboriginal steppers. Where would an ability to step have been of more use than in the arid heart of Australia? If his ancestors had been able to exploit a sheaf of worlds, even just in emergencies, the resources available to them would have been multiplied hugely, and they had had 60,000 years to discover how. But even so, surely not in such numbers as today. Maybe this was a new dream time, he thought, a replay of the age when the ancestors had moved across an empty landscape, and in doing so, had brought the land itself into being. It was the turn of his generation to become the new ancestors, to begin a new dream time that might encompass all of the long earth. And this time, they would shape a landscape no white colonist could ever appropriate. So here was Thomas, with a cell phone in his pocket, sitting by a rock, alone in this world. He could go back and report his bit of archaeology at last. Or maybe it was his own time to go walkabout. He could strip down to his boxers, just dump everything, and wander off. Living off the endlessly generous land, he became a coma. This was before the word itself, derived from beachcoma, had become common currency. In due course, he would start to hear legends of Joshua Valiente and other super-steppers, legends that were spreading across the long earth, and he would begin to take a more academic view of those who shared his new lifestyle. And then he met Joshua himself, in the silence of a very distant America. "But all that lay in the future," he told Helen now. "As I remember it, I just patted the hunting man West 10, and straightened up and touched my stepper, and I was gone for good." She smiled. "The long earth has given us all stories, I guess." "Too right. So what about yours? Tell me about this place, Reboot. Another coffee?" Chapter 12. They spent 3 more weeks in Valhalla, trying to get Dan used to the place and to the idea of coming here to school, even though Headmaster Jacques Montcute and the taciturn Roberta had in the meantime left for the datum to join the Chinese expedition. Helen had plenty of time to sample the local cuisine, including lots more coffee, enough to establish that, whatever Valhalla was good at, coffee wasn't it. But that was remedied once they boarded the Gold Dust. In the first 24 hours, Helen spent most of her time relaxing, sitting in the family's saloon, sipping the finest coffee she'd drunk since the last time her father had taken her to a Dayton Madison mom-and-pop local coffee shop, aged about 12, before they left the old world behind for good. That was the Gold Dust for you. It was like the best hotel in all the world, she thought, uprooted and drifting in the sky, an 800-foot-long envelope, from which hung a gondola of polished high-mega hardwood, like one vast piece of furniture. Helen had felt embarrassed just to climb aboard. Even the gangplank was carpeted, and you could have lost their whole hell-knows-where house in the reception hall. Of course, they were honored guests, Joshua, Dan, Helen, even Bill Chambers, and Sally Lindsay, who Helen noticed wasn't too high-minded to hitch a ride aboard this flying palace. Honored because of Joshua, of course, the hero explorer. If he wished, the Joshua Valiente could dine out on his legend. But he hardly ever did. Full of contradictions, her Joshua. But when he got offered such treats as this ride in the Gold Dust, he'd learned not to turn them away. That was how Helen had trained him, anyhow. Dan was in his element, of course. He'd wanted to be a Twain driver since he could walk, and would run after even the scrubby little local ships that drifted over hell knows where. Helen had thought his eyes would pop out when they walked aboard the Gold Dust. But there was some concern for him at the beginning. This was Dan's first long-distance haul. Helen was not a natural stepper, while Joshua was the world's model natural stepper. Just as his colouring was mixed, Dan had his father's dark hair but his mother's paler complexion. As a stepper, Dan was somewhere in between his parents. And in his genetic background, he did have a phobic uncle, Helen's brother Rod, who couldn't step at all. The medical treatments for controlling the symptoms of stepping nausea were advanced now, so that almost everybody could withstand even a high-speed journey like this, Almost all, but not quite all. If Dan had shown any distress, it would have been the end of the journey for his parents. Well, for Helen, anyhow. She had no doubt Joshua would have gone on with Sally, and the end of a dream for Dan. Joshua and Helen were both privately relieved when the ship's surgeon, who had been hovering over the passengers as the twain set off, gave them a discreet thumbs up. After that, the crew made a huge fuss of Dan. At Helen's insistence, he was to be accompanied at all times by either one of his parents or a junior crew member appointed by the captain. The crewman told Dan his name was Bosun Higgs, and Helen didn't believe that for a second. But apart from that, the crew gave Dan the run of the ship, from the ladders and gantries inside the envelope itself, with its huge sacks of helium, to the gondola's cargo hold and engine room, and the staterooms and restaurant come ballroom, even the wheelhouse, a huge transparent walled blister at the prow, where you could watch the great ships rising from world after world to join the fleet as it ploughed east towards the datum, with views of the American Sea and its forest-coated fringe shivering by, a new world with every heartbeat. An incredible, thrilling sight, even to a sedentary type like Helen. On the second evening of the voyage, the grown-ups had a treat when they dined at the captain's table. What else would you expect for the Valiente family? The restaurant was at the prow, just beneath the wheelhouse itself. Helen couldn't believe how ornate the place was, with white wooden filigree work everywhere, and gilt mammoth tusks, and oversized acorns hanging in the corners, and what looked like original oil paintings of various long earth scenes hanging on the walls, and armchairs and carpets, soft as puppy fur. Even a chandelier hanging over the table. All of which was a pleasant distraction from their fellow diners, who were generally the obnoxiously rich. Long earth traders splashing the profits, or tourists from the datum on the cruise of a lifetime, who mistook Helen and Joshua for staff more than once. The view outside was the main attraction. From the captain's table, right up by the forward window, you could see the worlds flash by below, and the gleaming hulls of the companion ships of the fleet, dozens of them hanging like Chinese lanterns under the changing sky. They had already travelled a long way. At its top speed of a step a second, the twain could cover the best part of 90,000 worlds a day, but they would be slower than that on average, and it would take some weeks to reach the datum. As the evening gathered in, most of the landscapes that washed beneath the ship's prow were dark, largely uninhabited, though one sparkled with town lights, and the captain told them that this was America, the new Dutch nation, one whole copy of the footprint of the United States, given by the federal government. The long earth hadn't been much use to the Dutch at first, since on all the stepwise worlds the landscapes they had spent centuries carefully preserving from the sea were still drowned. The climax of the show, the captain had timed the meal so they could witness the specific moment, just as the dessert trolley reached their table, and just as the setting sun touched the horizon, came when the great American sea, the inland ocean whose footprint had been their constant companion since they left Valhalla, melted away, first crumbling into scattered lakes, then submitting to a forest cover that stretched as far as the eye could see, dark green-black in the light of the setting sun. Helen's heart ached a bit when they lost contact with their sea, or at least its footprint. But as the light faded further, they began to see what had taken its place, below the prow. A river, wide and placid, a shining ribbon, cutting across the land. It was the Mississippi, or a remote cousin of that great river on the datum, a constant in most Americas. Indeed, hell knows where stood on the banks of one stepwise copy. The river would be an unfailing companion for the rest of the trip. They had a hell of a time getting Dan to sleep after that. Helen blamed the dessert, too much chocolate. Joshua, meanwhile, went off to find Bill, who'd spent his own raucous night with the crew. Chapter 13. The good people of Four Waters City, deep in a stepwise Idaho, seemed happy to see the USS Benjamin Franklin appear in the skies above their town. They quickly threw a kind of mass lunch for the dirigible's entire 50-person crew. The beef was so flavoursome and so relished that the ghost of the steer was probably looking down approvingly, Maggie thought. But afterwards, the conversation soon grew tricky, to say the least. Captain Maggie Kaufman strolled along the main, indeed the only, drag of Four Waters City. Somewhere in the region of 150,000 steps from the datum, set in a typical Corn Belt farming world, the place was neatly laid out and was bustling with people. It looked at first glance like Dodge City without the gunplay, but with, of course, the inevitable mobile communications tower, courtesy of the Black Corporation. Maggie's local guide, Mayor Jacqueline Robinson, pointed out with some pride various other civic improvements, including a reasonable hospital, which the town shared with similar cities in neighbouring stepwise worlds. But the mayor, a tough-looking woman of about 50, was oddly tense, nervous. Maggie wondered if that was because of the small stands of cannabis she saw flourishing in one or two gardens, along with a few other exotic blooms, out in open view by the street. When Mayor Robinson finally noticed Maggie looking, she said,
"Actually, that's mostly just hemp. Blameless. Gives a good fabric for working clothes. My maternal family were originally Czech. My grandfather told me that one day the cops raided what was eventually to have been his new shirt."
Maggie let that stand. She knew when to let silence do the questioning. Then she said, "Mostly?" Robinson admitted,
"Look, as for the other usage, the kids don't seem interested, and the opinion of the town meeting in this town is that for mature people it's okay, but keep the kids off it. Also, I have to tell you, there's some local stuff, an exotic flower in the woods to the west, native to this world, apparently." "Wow, that blows your head off. Even a walk in the woods. Well..."
She was talking too quickly. Eventually she ran down and shrugged.
"No offense to you, Captain, seeing as you are, in theory at least, a representative of the government. We have our own set of values here. I mean, we regard ourselves as American, bound by the Constitution, but we don't believe in any remote authority telling us what we should or should not be doing, or thinking, for that matter."
Maggie said, "I'm a serving Navy officer. I'm not a cop. In fact, traditionally, the Navy has specific directives against carrying out internal policing functions. Mayor Robinson, I'm not here to criticize or judge. On the other hand, we in the dirigible fleet are here to offer help. As captain, I do have a lot of discretion in how I interpret my orders." She wasn't sure how convincing that was. The mayor still betrayed that odd nervousness.
"Look, is there something else you want to tell me?"
Suddenly the mayor looked as if she'd been caught out doing something bad.
"What would you do? I mean, about something serious?"
Maggie repeated deliberately,
"I'm not a cop. Maybe we can help."
Robinson still looked uncertain, but with a nervous defiance she said at last,
"There has been a crime. In fact, two crimes. We're not sure how to handle the situation."
"Yes?"
"A child was harmed. Drugs." "Okay, it was drugs."
"And a murder."
Maggie felt her stomach turn, but she had thought that garbled defense of the local drug culture had been a little forced.
"Look," Robinson said, "I don't want to talk any more out here. We'd better go into my office."
Chapter 14. The crew of the USS Benjamin Franklin did not have a specifically military mission, even though the dirigible was a Navy vessel. The Franklin's voyage, a long jaunt across the long Earth, was, strictly speaking, an exercise in maintaining the integrity of the United States Aegis, the concept of which was still prized in Dayton, Washington, D.C., if nowhere else. Oh, the voyage did have scientific purposes. Every stepwise world was to be logged, every joker recorded. The crew was to sample novel life forms, geological formations and climatic conditions, and was specifically tasked to search for sapience wherever it could be found. So, a ship fit for such a mission, the Benjamin Franklin was no cargo scow. It was an extremely modern aircraft, bristling with scientific sensors as well as weapons. But the true reason for the voyage of the Benjamin Franklin was to travel the stepwise Earths within the footprint of the United States of America and to show the flag to as many of the new colonies out there as it could locate, or indeed discover. Many of them had not registered their existence with any datum authority. It was the job of the Franklin to find and count Americans, and to remind them that they were Americans. The operation had been launched 3 weeks before, on an April day in Richmond, Virginia, datum Earth. Maggie Kaufman had stood there in the open, in a downtown park, with her officers and crew. Executive Officer Nathan Boss and ship's chief surgeon Joe McKenzie at her side, before an empty stage with an unoccupied podium, a big stars and stripes dangling limply to either side, and a huge banner draped above. Unity is strength. This downtown park wasn't far from the north bank of the James, and, this being datum Earth, high-rise buildings had loomed out of the smog, some obviously abandoned, their windows boarded up like poked-in eyes. The hundreds of Navy personnel drawn up here were separated by a barrier from members of the public, lured in from across the datum city, and even neighboring worlds for the show. And it was quite a show, even if you weren't too impressed by rows of Navy grunts standing on their hind legs. The twains themselves were a staggering sight, you had to admit that. 6 brand new state-of-the-art military specification airships hanging in the sky, proudly constructed by a consortium of United Technologies, General Electric, the Long Earth Trading Company, and the Black Corporation. Shenandoah, Los Angeles, Akron, Macon, Abraham Lincoln, and Benjamin Franklin, 38-year-old Maggie's own command. Proud old names on proud new vessels, and the mightiest in the fleet, save only for the experimental USS Neil Armstrong, already dispatched on its own exploratory mission into the very remote stepwise west. At last, there had been a stir by the podium, and here came President Cowley, a heavy-set man, visibly sweating in his dark suit, and with lustrous hair, sprayed so thick it was like a plastic sculpture sitting on his head. He was flanked by security guys in regulation black suits and glasses. On stage, he was greeted by Admiral Hiram Davidson, USN. Based in Camp Smith, Hawaii, Davidson controlled the newly formulated Long Earth Military Command, U.S. LONGCOM. He in turn was shadowed by an aide, Captain Edward Cutler, a straight-as-a-die bureaucrat, if ever Maggie had met one, and he was welcome to the desk he commanded, as far as she was concerned. The famous, or notorious, Douglas Black was present in person too, one of a group of Poles and other dignitaries already lined up on the stage to shake Cowley's hand. Black was surprisingly short in person, Maggie thought, staring curiously. In his 70s, kind of wizened, bald, wrinkled, he looked like Gollum in sunglasses. Of course, it was Black who had donated the basic technology behind these military twains, the same technology that underpinned all stepping twains. He had a right to be here, if anybody had. And whether or not he was handing over money to Cowley's re-election campaign, he was probably funding both sides of a gaggle of independent candidates, Maggie's cynical side suspected. His presence was going to make this telegenic event even more so for Cowley. As the handshakes and backslaps proceeded on the stage, a chopper clattered overhead, a little bird, a sign of protection and menace. This mission and the launch event had been planned for some time, but in response to the Valhalla Declaration, the military symbolism had been beefed up. But as Cowley approached the podium, despite all the hoopla and the obvious politicking, Maggie Kaufman felt a visceral thrill to be standing here in front of the president himself. Cowley started to speak, his voice amplified, his face projected on a screen behind him. After some good old boy introductory stuff, he cut to the chase.
On step day, it was as if a tremendous door opened in the wall of the world to reveal a beguiling new landscape. And what were people going to do with that? Why, some of them were just going to walk away. Those who believed that a better life waited for them out there, rather than on this fine green world God gave to us, which we must now call the Datum. And off they went, every family that ever felt dispossessed, every gang or cult or faction that felt it could do better someplace else, the restless, the antisocial, the just plain curious, all of them went stepping off down the trek trails into the blue yonder. I can't deny the appeal of it. It was a door that couldn't be locked. Not ever again. History will show that we lost fully a fifth of mankind from the Datum Earth. The true Earth. In the first few years after Step Day. And we all know the consequences of that.
He waved a hand at the mute buildings around the park, the boarded-up high-rises, and there was a growl of agreement from sections of the crowd.
We are poor. We who remained in our homes to care for our families, to do our duty, we are poor. We who were left behind. Not only that, suddenly our secure world was open up to threats, new kinds of threats, pan-dimensional threats we never faced the like of before.
The screen behind him filled up with images, a kaleidoscope of horrors, from notorious would-be assassins, terrorists, rapists, child abductors and murderers who'd quickly learned to exploit the destructive potential of stepping, to a gaggle of grubby high-megas bandits, who looked as though they'd stepped out of a spaghetti western, to some of the existential weirdness that had come down the turnpike from the strange new worlds. Distorted-looking humanoids wearing mockeries of human clothing, and Mary, the gentle-eyed yet murderous troll, a picture that brought boos from the crowd.
That is why I, as your commander-in-chief, have assembled a new force from across our fine armed services to deal with these new situations. It is called U.S. Long Com, as an analogy with our nation's other geographical commands. Many of its members are gathered here today in the historic heart of Richmond, Virginia, and many thousands more are in training at sites around the world, and indeed in the nearby Stepwise neighborhood. Let's show them our appreciation!
He led applause, which rippled around the watching crowd.
And today, Cowley boomed on, I announce their first significant mission, Operation Prodigal Son.
More scattered applause, a little puzzled.
I'm sure the name I chose is self-explanatory. This is a mission not to oppose any foe, but to reach out to our own lost children. A demonstration not of military power, but of the firm hand of strong parenting. In these six fine new aircraft, companies of our young warriors will set out across the worlds, heading west, and showing their strength to the colonies.
And he emphasized the quotes with crooks of his fingers. There were a few whoops at that, and cries of,
Kick butt!
And,
Turn Valhalla into a twain pork!
Cowley held up his hands.
Let me emphasize again, this is not a punitive mission. Indeed, my administration has nothing but support for those entrepreneurs who are busily developing the economies of the so-called low earths as contributions to the overall national good. Our argument is not with them. Our argument is with those who live further out, some living entirely unproductive and feckless lives, who are prepared to accept the protection of life in the American Aegis and yet contribute nothing to its upkeep.
More applause and whoops. Now Cowley held up a bit of paper.
I have here their so-called Declaration of Independence. Nothing but a mockery of this nation's finest hour.
Theatrically, he ripped up the paper to more cheers.
This operation will reach a climax when its overall commander, Admiral Davidson here, stands on the steps of the City Hall at the rebel enclave of Valhalla and welcomes those particular prodigals back into the bosom of the national family. America has scattered across the worlds. Now is the time to gather those lost flocks back together again. Time to pick up the pieces and grow strong again in unity.
And he gestured up at the slogan over his head. Now he turned to the troops ranked before him.
And to fulfill this holy mission, I turn to these fine young people. Isaiah 6, verse 8. Also, I heard the voice of the Lord, saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then said I, Here am I. Send me. Who shall I send on Operational Prodigal Son? Who will go for us?
They had been coached to respond.
I'll go. Send me. Send me.
The discipline of the ranks softened a little as the sailors and marines whooped and yelled. Beside Maggie, Joe McKenzie grunted in grudging appreciation.
Cowley may be a slimeball, but he is still the president.
And he's supple, Doc, Maggie murmured. Here he is, pleasing one constituency by appearing to take on the colonists, while appeasing the colonists by presenting our mission as a kind of embrace.
Mac glanced up at the heavily armed twains.
Some embrace. That isn't Santa's sleigh up there. We'll be lucky if we don't provoke some kind of shooting war.
It won't come to that.
Well, however it turns out, you can't beat being given a mission to fulfill.
Ain't that the truth? Said Maggie.
Of course, once they were actually out in the Long Earth, they had encountered much wariness about their mission. Many Long Earth pioneers, at least the first generation, had left the datum precisely because they had been intensely suspicious of central government, deriving from a country in which, from its founding, that sentiment had always run deep. What could the datum government offer a far stepwise colony now? It could threaten attacks, but provided damn few services, and over the years had withdrawn what little it had once offered. Protection? The major problem with that argument was that there was no detectable adversary, no bad guys to spy on or shadow, no bogeymen to point to as hostiles. China was still reeling from its own post-Step Day revolution. The parallel Europes were filling up with peaceful farmers. A new generation of Africans were reclaiming their ravaged continent, or stepwise copies of it, and so on. There was no threat to counter. However weak the case, Maggie Kaufman knew she was expected to diplomatically remind these estranged colonial sheep that they were part of a bigger flock, because back in D.C. there was a profound sense that, under the American aegis, this newly extended country was fragmenting, and that, it was instinctively felt, couldn't be allowed. That had been true even before the provocative Declaration of Independence that had come out of Valhalla. All that was for the future. Right now, Maggie found the present hard enough to manage. A horrible ethical and legal knot for her raw crew to untangle, in a ship still being shaken down that they'd encountered just weeks after Cowley's send-off.
Chapter 15. The office of the mayor of Four Waters City was predictable pioneering architecture, though a veritable mansion compared with anything that Daniel Boone would have known, Maggie thought. However, he would have recognized and approved of the drying pelts, the jars of pickles in the corner, the miscellaneous shovels and other gardening implements, all the detritus of a pioneering life busily being lived. And there was a basement, which suggested that the mayor and her family were thoughtful people, and perhaps mildly paranoid, or sensibly cautious. It was impossible for an intruder to step into an underground room.
"The child," Robinson blurted. "Let's get to it, Captain."
"Fine." Maggie sat down.
"Her name is Angela Hartman. It happened a week ago. She was found by her family, stoned out of her mind."
"Sorry."
"She wouldn't wake up. She was in a kind of coma. Took days to come out of it. We know who did it, who gave her the drugs and got high with her, and we know who committed the murder."
"What murder? Where are these people now?"
The mayor shrugged.
"It never dawned on us before to build a jail. We were building a stone ice house for the winter. We use that. It's pretty well made. I don't think anyone could possibly get out of it. It's real big and heavy."
"And this is where you put the guy who gave the kid the drugs?"
Robinson glanced at her.
"I'm sorry, you've misunderstood."
"I've not been clear. I kind of gabble stuff out when I'm nervous. That bastard isn't in the ice house. That bastard's in the mortuary, such as it is.
The guy we're keeping in the ice house, he was the father of the little girl."
"Ah, so the father found the pusher and killed him."
"Okay."
Maggie began to see it. "Two crimes, the drugs, the murder. Nobody's denying any of this, but as a result of all this, we are
riven
about how to handle this, what to do with the father."
"Why me?" Maggie thought to herself. She was supposed to be cheerfully showing the flag and maintaining goodwill. Right now, Nathan Boss, her XO, was out bartering for fresh vegetables. And now this. Well, why not me? This is what I came out here for.
"I take it you haven't tried to contact the datum authorities?"
Robinson flushed.
"To tell you the truth, we were scared. We never even told the datum that we were here. We thought it wasn't their business after all."
"And there's no local justice system in the Stepwise neighborhood?"
She shook her head. Maggie sat in silence, letting the moment extend.
"Very well. Here's what you're going to do. First of all, you are going to get your act together and make it clear to the datum government that you are here. We'll help you with that, and such details as ratifying property claims. Then you have a man in custody without trial, or any due process, and we need to sort that out. Look, to repeat, I'm not here with any mandate to police you, but we can help. And before all that, you're going to let my ship's doctor have a good look at the girl."
A few hours later, Joe McKenzie came out of the Hartman house. Mac was in his 50s, grizzled, beaten up by a long career in emergency and battlefield medicine. He was old for a field posting, in fact. Maggie had helped him bend the regulations to have him at her side on this mission. This bright afternoon, the doctor's expression was as dark as twilight.
"You know, Maggie, sometimes there are no words. If I were to say that it could have been worse, you need to understand that even so, I would like to spend some time alone in a room with the gentleman concerned and a baseball bat, knowing with surgical precision the right spots to hit."
It was at times like this that Maggie was glad she'd stuck to her career, never married, never had kids of her own, left the glorious burden of caring for children to her siblings, cousins, friends. She was happy to be an aunt, honorary or otherwise.
"It's okay, Mac."
"Well, no, it isn't okay. Not for that little girl, and may never be again. I'd prefer her to be sent to a datum hospital for a full examination. At the least, I'll want to take her up onto the ship for observation for a while."
Maggie nodded. "Let's go meet the leaders of this joint."
They met in the mayor's office. At Maggie's side were Mac and Nathan Boss. Maggie had invited Robinson herself and a few chosen citizens from the town meeting, whom the mayor reckoned to be well-balanced and sensible. at least by the standards of this community, to consider the verdict. As they sat down, everybody looked to the captain, looked to her as a saviour, she realised. Maggie cleared her throat. Time to step up to the plate, she thought.
For the record, and we are being recorded, this session is nothing more than a panel of inquiry. Judicial processes can follow as necessary. I have no policing role here, but I have taken it upon myself, at the request of the mayor of the town, to ascertain fairly all the facts of the matter. I'll summarize what I've been told. The facts are apparently not being denied. A week ago, Roderick Bacon plied with drugs Angela Hartman, a girl of 9 years old, the daughter of Raymond Hartman and Daphne Hartman. Hearing the girl cry out, her father, Ray Hartman, rushed to her room and saw Bacon with her. The girl was vomiting, fitting. Hartman pulled the man away, handed the girl to her mother, and then beat Bacon, dragged him out of the house, and set about him again, causing, after a minute or two, his death. The neighbors, alerted by the screams, told us that Bacon was pleading for his life, saying that a lurid angel made him do it, made him want to give this pure child the gift of his own inner light. You get the picture. In the absence of a lawyer, I've had my XO, Commander Nathan Boss, take a personal statement from Hartman about the events of that night, and also a statement by Bacon's wife. And according to the wife, before the crime, Bacon had been out processing a harvest of the apparently psychoactive flowers endemic in the woods hereabouts. He ran a side business of dubious legality, selling the stuff in stepwise whirls. Maggie stopped there. She wished she'd had better training for something like this. She looked around at the others in the room. For the record, the child will be cared for overnight on the Benjamin Franklin under the care of Dr. Mackenzie. I'll invite the girl's mother to spend the night with her daughter. I'll send a crewman down to escort her up to the ship. Meanwhile, well, Bacon is dead, and Ray Hartman is in custody. I think I understand the feelings of all involved in this. I'm no lawyer, I'm no judge, but I can give you my personal assessment. I have to say that Bacon was guilty, in any reasonable sense of the word. He knowingly exposed himself to narcotics, these flowers from the woods. My view is he's responsible for his behavior thereafter. As for Hartman, murder is murder. Yet I find myself loath to condemn the actions of an overwrought husband and father. So what next? We'll file a report, and in the end the datum cops will come out here, go through this fully, refer it to the judicial system. But that could take years. The Aegis is a big place and tough to police. In the meantime, you have Ray Hartman stuck in that ice house. What to do with him? Well, frankly, you, all of you, must be judge and jury, prosecution and defense. We can leave you advice on due process, but it's up to you to run your own affairs. And I urge you to work out how to deal with this yourselves, within U.S. law, as best you understand it. She eyed them one by one. This kind of autonomy was, after all, presumably, what you wanted when you came out here. In the longer term, get together with your stepwise neighbors. I'm sure that together you could support the equivalent of a county court. I'm told that's becoming common in the colony worlds. Hire a lawyer or two. Even a visiting circuit judge. She ran out of steam. She stood up. That's all from me. The rest is up to you as a community. But for God's sake, Nathan, make sure the science boys take samples first. And make sure they do this when the wind isn't blowing into the town. Burn those flowers. That's all, people. At least for today. I'll have the minutes of this session ready for you all tomorrow. That evening, Maggie met Joe Mackenzie coming out of the ship's small medical bay. How is she? She asked.
Thank goodness I spent a semester in a children's hospital before I signed up.
Would coffee help?
In Maggie's sea cabin, Mackenzie accepted the mug with gratitude, and after two blessed swigs, said,
You know, the bastard got what was coming to him. in my personal view. But we are officers of the United States Navy. Even Wyatt Earp had to look as if he respected the law.
I'm hoping they'll work that out for themselves. Plenty of other communities out here have done.
But other communities don't have those damn flowers. And to me, there was a definite feel of hippie about the place. You know what I mean? The feeling that people aren't taking care of business. The counterculture gone bad scenario. Too many people frazzled out of their brains.